What gave you the courage to engage in the conversation of 100 days?
I've been asked that, but I still grapple with the idea of courage because I wasn't thinking about courage. I was thinking about how it's been 20 years and how, I don't know, I really wasn't thinking about courage.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Ugandan poet Julianne Okot-Bitek about her award-winning collection of poems, 100 Days, written in response to the Rwandan genocide 20 years later. This interview was recorded with the support of CITR at the University of British Columbia. Stay with us. It was in 2014 you began responding to the Kenyan visual artist Wangeshi Mutu's postings on social media.
Mm-hmm. She had just posted one photo, and as soon as she posted it, it was the photo of a woman holding a sign written 100, and I knew somehow she was going to count down. And so I'd written to her and I said, "Can I post a poem along with your photos?" And she said that she was hoping, or she was wishing. Well, I guess it just so happened that it was going to work together. I don't want to be quoting her wrongly or anything, right? But she said yes. And so every day we posted, and she didn't have to wait for me, and I didn't have to wait for her, but we did that every day, 400 days.
You write in the back of the book that there were times when it just seemed like both of your work spoke to each other without planning.
Mm-hmm. But I suppose we were tapping into the same thing and grappling with the idea of what it means to consider 20 years after such an event or such a time.
Julianne, will you begin by reading day 100 and day 99?
Okay. Day 100. It was the earth that betrayed us first. It was the earth that held onto its beauty, compelling us to return. It was the breezes that were there and then not there. It was the sun that rose and fell, as if there was nothing different, as if nothing changed. Day 99. It was sunrise every morning, the same land, same sky, same rivers, hills, and valleys. It was the same road that led away and back home, the same sweet air that amplified the voices through whispers, gossip, and airwaves. Words leaped into our eyes and burned this new knowledge that never was new. But it was the earth that betrayed us first, in those 100 days that would never end.
Thank you. When I was reading the work, it became clear that the land is a character or a force. And I wanted to know, how does the land betray the speaker of this first poem and second poem?
It was the idea that such awfulness can be happening and the land remains steady under our feet. It's the idea that you expect the world to be in tumult because you are, right? And you expect bad things to be happening everywhere because you're having a hard time. It's a way of being inside your own trouble that prevents you from seeing anything else around you. And so it feels like a betrayal. It's not an accusation, it's a feeling really, right?
And your words also confront the sky. In day 78, you write, "How else to explain a sky that witnesses and still insists on magical hues of itself?" And I was thinking exactly of that space, that tender space between being soothed and in awe that the world goes on and is still beautiful, and also furious that the world can hold the horror and not be changed by it.
Right. And so at the same time, what seems to be so horrific to us in our lives, in our experiences, in our time on earth, is a small blip in the history of the world.
Right. Right.
It's a small moment. And maybe the sky that is seen, apparently there's no sky, but whatever that blue has witnessed through time, what does this moment of ours mean to it? And why should it stop being beautiful? For us? Really? It doesn't take away from how badly we suffer, though.
No. There's also an interplay between God and faith. And you include scripture and questions and indictments of God. You write, "Why, God, have you forsaken us?" What's the conversation or the argument that you're having with faith?
I'll go a little bit back before I can come back to it, before I can return to this, all right?
Yes.
I was brought up in a Christian faith. So I was baptized Catholic, and when I was in high school, and then I went to an Anglican high school where I got my confirmation. So I've had the Bible in my life as a constant text. I don't read it all the time, and I don't necessarily believe everything in it, but I know it. And so I know that one of the tenets of Christianity is faith. And this is, I suppose, a tenet of many religions or other religions. And so if one is to be rewarded for their faith and sometimes tested for their faith, what does it mean when the testing is unrelenting? How are we supposed to deal with that? Because even the Bible, there's the book of Job who was tested and tested and tested and tested. It's only one book.
Yeah.
There's not enough in the scripture to guide us to what is happening around us when things are so bad, is really what I want to say.
Mm-hmm. In your author's note, you write about being inspired by the Rwandan poet and survivor Yolande Mukagasana, who lost her husband and children, but you write, "Hers wasn't a litany of losses, and yet she lost her whole family." Do you remember what it was about her words that imprinted on you?
I'm just covered in goosebumps to think about Yolande again, because I met her many years ago in Colombia. We were both at a poetry festival, and I've only just been in touch with her last week since then. A decade, it's been 10 years, and I've been looking for her contact. I've been wanting to send her a copy of 100 Days, and it's only last week that I got in touch with her. And I remember, it's not that it's my story to tell, and it isn't really,
right?
But I remember being struck by the fact that she said she only started to write poetry after the genocide. And that was very powerful. One of the poems I have in this book, I should know it. It's one of the early ones. It's about a poet. Oh, yeah, it's day 97. It was my recollection of the story that she had told us. So I thought about her for a long, long time. And that's also why I dedicate the book to her, because I learned from that small story that she told us that even though it is many times it is words that lead us into trouble, the stories we tell ourselves and we are told about who we are in the world, it is also words that we can return to have a sense of who we are in this same world, mm-hmm. right? So then poetry seems to be a good place to go to or to come from.
You mentioned this not being the story to tell, and yet you also ask in the author's notes, how could it be that the only Africans to think about the genocide would be from Rwanda, and yet the genocide was ours too? It was a crime against us, East Africans and Africans. And so I want to know about how did you move through that space of being a witness and of trusting that you could do the work?
Well, I'm from Northern Uganda. I'm an Acholi woman from Northern Uganda, and my hometown is Gulu. And for many people, the reference to Northern Uganda will be the Lord's Resistance Army and the guerrilla war that took place there from 1986 to 2007. Now, the LRA started in 1987, right?
Mm-hmm.
20 years, there was a war in my homeland. And I know what it feels like to be so helpless that there's a war happening in your homeland and the world continues around it. I also know that what I read about Rwanda was always from foreign voices. Foreign in the sense that they were not African. And aside from Yolande at the time, there was no one else I had read. And it could be that I just didn't have access. It could be a lot of people write in French and my French is not good enough to be reading. And I also don't live in a French-speaking city. So, you know, it could be many things. But then the references that I had about Rwanda were from non-Rwandan people. Uh-huh. And also non-African people. Mm-hmm. And so given what was happening in my homeland, and given that I'm also from East Africa, I didn't see any other way out. We have to stand in solidarity with each other, right? And if your neighbor's house is burning, it's an old saying, you don't just stand aside and watch because you know the fire can leap to your own house.
Right.
Yeah. So I had to write something.
It takes me to a point in your book, which I said to you before the interview, that I read in one sitting and I was entranced. And I got halfway through the book and it felt like a horse had kicked me in the chest. And I want to ask you to read day 53.
Okay. Day 53. There were echoes if one listened for them. This wasn't the first time. There were echoes in Acholi. There were echoes in Armenia, in the Americas, Bangladesh, Bosnia, Cambodia, China, and the Congo. There were echoes in Darfur. There were echoes in England. There were echoes in Finland, in Georgia, Germany, Hawaii, India, Ireland, Japan, Kenya, Latvia, and Mongolia. There were echoes in Nairobi and echoes in Orange County and Ovamboland, Poland, Palestine, Queensland, Russia, and South Africa, Southern Sudan, Tonga, Uganda, Vietnam, Wales. There were echoes in xenophobic attacks everywhere, Yugoslavia, Zimbabwe. The earth palpitates as if it needs violence, as if violence is a heartbeat. If not here, over there. If it's not over there, it's on its way over here. Ours wasn't the first or the only one. It was merely our most painful.
Thank you. The two lines, the earth palpitates as if it needs violence, as if violence is a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. How did you come to those lines?
That's a big question.
Yeah. I mean, not that you can even know, but or what was it like for you when those lines came to you?
That's another big question. I write not necessarily in the moment, but also in the moment. I think, let me try and just recapture what I was thinking as I was writing this.
Yeah.
I was thinking that, and I went through the alphabet and I found there are many places in the world that have had terrible things happen and continue to. You don't have to go through the alphabet for that. But if you pay attention, there's something and somebody hurting all the time. Mm-hmm. And so why if it's not a need? Right? It's a terrible question to ask, but it's also rhetorical in the sense that it doesn't need an answer. And that's why it's as if it needs violence, not that it does need violence. But the echo makes us feel as if that's the case, right?
Yeah.
And this poem, in a strange and violent way, was a way to say, we are not alone. And this is not happening to us because of who we are, even though it seems that it's happening to us because of who we are, right? But we're not alone. We're never alone in our experience.
When I heard you read it, it sounded like an incantation.
Mm-hmm. It should be. And the thing about incantations is that it can take you to a meditative space.
Yeah.
Where you stop thinking. It can clear your head to see more clearly. It can comfort you, or it can just make you stop thinking about it altogether, which is how we often respond to the news. It confirms what we know, or we stop thinking about it, right?
Yeah, I think I'm shocked now sitting here thinking that to be soothed by an incantation of tragedy, you know, and what we are capable of doing to each other, and yet that's what poetry can capture, is something that makes us feel less alone.
When we watch the news every night, we see these incantations happening, being performed, right? It doesn't move us to do anything. Not usually, anyway.
It takes me to a line that you've written in Day 58. You say, as long as we're caught in the never-againness of things, we are mm-hmm. blinded to the hundred daysness of then. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're also pointing out, is the way we falsely take a stand that also puts us in a place of ignorance or inaction?
Yeah, I mean, to think of the term never again, and many of us will think about Second World War, after the Second World War, the idea that we will never allow this to happen again. But even after the Second World War, there has been another world war, at least the one in East Africa. And several million people died in the wars between Uganda, the Congo, and Rwanda. And, you know, so many people. So what was that never again about? Or is it about only one place and one war? Right now in Canada, I don't know if you've caught this, there's a charge of the government continuing a genocide against the Indigenous women.
Yeah.
And it's a big word. And the report has come out to say that it cannot be other than genocide, because it fits the definition, and because there's been an ongoing racist, colonialist, and sexist war on Indigenous women here. But the media is so caught up in the word genocide, and how can this possibly apply to Canada? Completely ignoring the idea that, of course, it applies if you look at the definition of genocide. But we want to think, oh no, it can't happen in Canada because genocide is a word that applies to other people in other places with other colors of skin and other years and other centuries, perhaps. You see? So this poem would be speaking to today, really. And in that focus on the term genocide, the harm continues to be perpetrated against Indigenous women here.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Ugandan poet Julianne Okot-Bitek about her collection of poems 100 Days, written in response to the Rwandan genocide of 1994. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. I'm thinking of a poem about a machete, and I was wondering if you would read Day 91.
Oh, that wasn't even a poem.
Say more.
That was me trying to capture a moment, and the moment is in the poem. So I'll read it, maybe then I can talk about it.
Yes, I love that. Thank you.
Okay, Day 91. We couldn't have known 9 days in that it would ever be over. It was a time warp that had us in flashes and then in woozy moments that took forever. A machete hangs in a museum in Ottawa. A machete hangs perpetually in a museum in Ottawa. A machete hangs like a mockery of time, like a semblance of that reality in which another machete and other machetes hanged for what seemed like a long time, but eventually they came down again and again and again and again. Even time measured in machete strokes can never be accurate. I had gone to Ottawa. It might have been for a conference some years ago. And I had a chance to go to this museum. And I think it's a museum of war, I think. And I was at an exhibit where, I mean, this war stuff happening, right? And there's a section on Rwanda. They had the display of the covers of Time magazine. And they had in another section the actual car that Hitler drove. And there's a crack in the window. And all kinds of memorabilia, letters from World War soldiers and to their mothers and the uniforms. But there's this one machete that was hanging by an invisible thread. You know those ones that makes it look as if it's just hanging? And I was so gripped by that image, I was expecting it to fall. And of course, the 1994 Rwanda genocide was given to us in the visuals of the machete, which up until then, for me, was a farming implement. And then it became a weapon of death for killing people, right? Not for clearing bushes. And so I remember standing there and being petrified in the moment and thinking, oh, Jesus. I think there might have been an inscription. I could be making it up in my head, but there might have been an inscription that this is a machete that was brought for this exhibit from Rwanda. Exactly, right?
Yeah.
And so I was caught up in that gasp that you just had, like, right? Yeah, and so this was my attempt to write it down. And because it's day 91, it's still going to be like 89 more days, or is it 91 more days to go before people start thinking that the genocide ended after 100 days? Yeah.
100 days of it hanging there.
Yeah. But even the falseness of that idea that 100 days did it stop, were they all held by an invisible thread? Yeah.
I'm going to move in the direction of this term reconciliation. In the foreword of the book, Canadian poet Cecily Nicholson says that your book questions the rote offerings of an insincere, immaterial, and governmental reconciliation. And Julianne, I was hoping that you would also read Day 87.
Okay. Day 87. Reconciliation is a grand thing. Reconciliation photographs well. Reconciliation makes people smile. Reconciliation feels good, dresses well, writes well, conjures good dreams. Reconciliation is minding my business. Reconciliation is minding my life. Reconciliation is aimed at my head. Reconciliation leaves me no choice, don't get me wrong. Reconciliation wants me to wipe my tears, to wipe the slate clean. It wants me to forget my firstborn daughter, the one I could not bury.
What, I want to say something like, how do we hold this? How do we talk about it now? You know, as a world, as nations, as people who sat by or stood by and let this happen.
I don't know about talking. And I probably should say at some point in this interview that I'm not from Rwanda. I'm not Rwandan. And I wasn't writing about the Rwandan experience. I was writing about what it means to think about 20 years after the Rwanda genocide. But when I say I'm not sure it's about talking, I'm really wanting to think about listening. Because so often there's this whole business of speaking for those who cannot speak for themselves, or saving people from distress, or doing stuff so that we can feel better about what we are doing. There's less time for listening, or as they say, offering space so that those who have something to say, or even nothing to say, can be there. Right?
Yeah.
So how do we talk about it? I would say we don't talk about it. We wait to listen. or we wait for guidance from those who would teach us something or tell us something or have something to offer.
I'm thinking about the places in your work where you actually strike through your own writing, where you cross out your writing.
Right.
What are you meaning to do when you make those kinds of moves?
Let me get an example in front of me so
yeah.
I can talk to it.
Day 90 is where I first encountered it. You strike out about reconciliation and forgiveness. You strike out the phoenix rise again and grief overcome.
Oh, yeah. This is how the poem, without the striked out sections, this is how the poem was. And then I started to look at it and look at it and look at it. And it seemed to me that all the pointers towards reconciliation, right? Humanity and good and the power of God and miracles and all those were actions or results that would make us all feel better about what happened. And so what would it mean to edit it out? So first I actually deleted them, like edited them out. And then it looked too clean. And so I put them back. So there would be a consideration of maybe three different poems. One which would just be the striked out section, very, very short. Mm-hmm. One which would be the whole poem, including the striked out section. And one would be without the edited section, right? So there were three poems in there. And there's a conversation about to be had between listening, the intent of overcoming, so that we don't have to talk about it ever again. We don't have to deal with it. Also, if we leave out the striked out section, that means we always have to deal with it because we can see it. We can see what we're trying to edit out in conjunction with what else we should be thinking about, right? To consider and mm-hmm. to see and to witness rather than to witness humanity and good, which would mean an edited way of witnessing, choosing not to see the terrible, for instance, right? Yeah. That's what I was thinking about with those, that striking.
Mm, yes. There's a line also from day 96 in which you write, "Why should beauty render us speechless?" And I was wanting to know about your relationship to beauty and what role beauty has in poetic moments and what role beauty has, again, sort of in these moments of terror.
I've been thinking about beauty for a long time. Most of the time when I think about beauty, I think about nature.
Mm-hmm.
Not to give it any kind of anthropomorphic quality, but how nature really doesn't care. It's just unabashed in itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the flower that blooms doesn't bloom for us. When we appreciate it, good for us. And if we don't see it, it's fine too. Right? It will still bloom. It will still be beautiful. But in the hands of an artist of any kind, whether it's a musician or a poet or a painter, beauty takes on a different role. For some people, it's the aesthetics to get people to pay attention, right? And for some people, at least for me, increasingly, it's a tool to present something else. So the way nature will produce flowers that will last for a week, then die, right? Wine might produce something that is so beautiful but deals with a terrible subject matter. But if you don't have the beauty to inculcate into the work,
mm-hmm.
why should anyone pay attention? Nobody wants to look at ugly in its ugly form, right?
Right.
So then beauty becomes a tool, not just an aesthetic to distract people, but as a way of presenting a difficult subject matter. And I'm thinking of the work of a Colombian artist called Erika Dietes.
Mm.
She's a photographer, but she also has... She also does other artistic productions. And she's got a Absolutely. She's got one called Relicarios. If you look it up, you'd see absolutely stunningly beautiful boxes of resin. And in those boxes of resin are artifacts from the Colombian War. Right?
Wow.
And they're beautifully lighted and presented. But in order to look at it, you have to be down on your knees. Right? Mm. So in the exhibit, it's a view of supplication. Everyone's in worship, really, to something that's really beautiful and also really hard. But those objects, on their own, marked shirt of somebody who was shot. It's impossible to take in. Mm. So anyway, that's how I think about beauty.
Thank you. Julianne, I've invited you to bring anything of your new body of work that you would want to share.
Okay. I was going to bring something from Gauntlet, which is the work I was telling you about. I'm really happy about it. But I thought, no, I wrote a poem to think about the 25th commemoration of the Rwanda genocide.
Yes.
And I read it at a university. I was invited to write something on commemorating the Rwanda genocide, or the 25th anniversary. And I thought, me? Commemorate? I really had a trouble with that term because I don't believe in that. But anyhow, I wrote a poem called Something About Commemoration. There's something today that is at once every day and also just today. Something about today that gels or scatters or crystallizes or muds over. Something about splendor, about light, about shaking off, shirking off, beating off, sweeping away. Something about incredulity, something about loss, something about dates, about moments, years. Something about a century in the making, many, many centuries in the making. Something about unity. Something incredible about the idea that we are one and the same, one and the same, one and the same, one and the same. That it happened to you and to me. That we all suffered, that we all suffered, that my heartbreak and yours come from the same place. There's something about the singular truth that will not be disputed by vast tributaries, each from a rivulet, a stream, a pond, a hole in the ground where we buried our dreams, where some seeded and grew into shrubs with pink flowers, red, a deep purple, and glorious yellow. Sing me a song. Sing me a song about your sister. Sing me a song about your sister who won't speak now but dances. About the one that won't dance but digs in the garden in rhythm with her own breath. About the one that won't hold a hoe but guides children. Look at the board. Look at the page. Follow the line with your finger. About the one that won't teach but will judge with a strong gavel. Guilty, not guilty. Guilty, not guilty. About the one that will not judge but prays for us sinners all the time. About the one that won't pray but insists on facts and decries prejudice. About the one with her hair dyed red who walks among traffic, whispering and pointing and sometimes laughing at comedy that only she can hear. Sing me a song. Sing me a song about the claim that we won't or can't ever forget, but what is it we want to remember? There's something about hauntings that persist. There's something about latency in the shoulder of a person who used to care. There's something about a thread, about weaving, about reckoning, about sewing, about giving and pulling back. There's something about the need to hold on, something in that detail, a missing third finger on his left finger. On his left hand, fingertip now gnarled. Sometimes he chews at it. Sometimes he forgets about it. Sometimes it takes him back to the moment when the car door slammed on his finger, how he couldn't pull his finger out, how he screamed, how the adults shouted, how someone banged at the car, how the car stopped, having not really gone yet. How he howled, how he pained, how he never thought he'd ever forget, oh my God, oh my God. What are these things you ask us to remember when we hold these stories in our bodies? The confidence of statues, the weight of monuments, the red of the forever flame, the speeches, the trees that were planted in line after line after line after line, 2 decades of woe. Look at the trunks of these trees. Look at how youthful they are. Look at how strong they are. Look at how similar their heights are. Same species, aren't they? Look at how by standing in the same spot, each tree spans towards the horizon. Look at heaven within their reach. Look at all the possibilities, all the possibilities, all of them. Look, look, look. Can you even imagine?
Julianne Okot-Bitek is a Kenyan-born Ugandan diasporian who now resides in Vancouver, British Columbia, where she's a poet, writer, and academic. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin's studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.